Hi there, my name is Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to this special hybrid edition of Shed Talks. That's right, today we are running on petrol and electricity, but not gas. Not so much a shed talk this episode as a shed chat. Bear with us, we're going to do more of these in the future, and you're going to love them. We are super lucky to have as our guest the gorgeous, multi-award winning novelist and broadcaster, stand-up comedian, Guardian blogger, ordained minister, A.L. Kennedy. Please welcome the wonderful Alison Kennedy.
Hello, nice to see you.
Great to see you. We're going to discuss today the pressures of being a writer, the effects of the lockdown, then and now, good and bad perils of being self-employed, particularly in terms of one's mental health, and how a dashboard of dials could make a difference. So, Alison, really great to see you. I always like your titling, and I loved your very first collection, Night Geometry and the Garscadden Trains. And I'm nervous about pronouncing Garscadden.
One of the few Scottish place names that you pronounce the way it's spelt, probably.
Right. And that is near Renfrew.
Garscadden is basically in Glasgow, really.
Right. But anyway, I like it. I just think it's Night Geometry is a great title, and I love all that. And I like also that your latest collection, We're Attempting to Survive Our Time. And I just thought to myself, we're not going to talk too much about books, but I just thought that was the timing of that was quite nifty, I think.
Well, as it turned out, it came out in hardback on the first day of the first lockdown, so it was slightly too nifty. The story spanned sort of 3 years, and that was the title that collection always had. But, you know, I had COVID very early, had long COVID.
Oh, did you? What, in the first sort of year of it?
Well, things like I took my mother for a... for a Christmas treat, a pre-Christmas treat on the 23rd of December, I think, 2019, I took her to the Tutankhamun exhibition in London. And as I was looking at the tightly pressed room full of people from all over the world, but about 50% the Far East,
China,
I was thinking, is this the best idea I ever had?
Yes.
Because we already knew. And indeed, we were iller than we'd ever been, and you know, had no sense of smell until
God.
Aprilish, and then it just became, you know, constant headaches, weakness, really being punished for doing exercise, terrible mental fog, horrific, which didn't go away until I had the first vaccine. And I went from having really too much of a workload and thinking on the day of the first lockdown, this is quite scary, don't know what's going to happen to the book, don't really know what's going to happen to anything. But equally, all of that work that I wasn't quite sure I was going to be able to fit in, and, you know, all of my desire for rest, they went away. Everything went away over the course of a week. And yeah, you're thinking, well, that means I'm not going to get paid. But also just thinking, oh, thank goodness for that. But also at that point, you know, I'd apparently got better from this thing, and then, you know, I thought I'll have a year to write the novel that I'd begun writing in a cabin in the woods in America. So, you know, I'd started it a little bit early, and I was thinking, that's great, I've got a clear year now, and I did almost nothing, and the stuff that I did was, you know, gibberish, because I couldn't do sentences. It got to the point where I couldn't get to the end of the sentence, and I couldn't remember nouns, and it was like I mean, I don't know, because I've never had dementia, but you were sort of thinking, you know, is my brain permanently not right?
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting that that's not, well, in my knowledge, that widely known. Because I think a lot of us have been thinking, God, I'm so forgetful, I can't remember this and I can't remember that.
Yeah, so yeah, you know, I mean, relatively mild for long COVID symptoms, but and actually I've got a neurologist friend and we were emailing back and forth the more he got of the raw research about what COVID is and what it does, and he was sort of saying, you don't want to get this, look at what it does to your brain.
Yeah.
And I sort of emailed back, I think it has done that to my brain, I think you're too late. And he sent me this little test of, you know, can you smell vinegar? Can you smell peanut butter? Can you smell peppermint? Can you? And it's like, no, can't smell any of that. You know, I could shove my nose into a bottle of vinegar
and not smell anything.
Nothing. Peppermint toothpaste. Nothing. You know, really pungent smells.
Gosh. Yeah. So basically, that lasted until the first vaccination, which was, well, that's almost 9 months later, a year later, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then that gave me a sort of post-viral thyroid condition, which is just calming down now. So, you know, sort of a stressful time.
So how did you keep yourself together during this whole period? I mean, you know, I know you're quite a disciplined person. Did you create a new routine or did you just go, F off, I'm actually just going to bed? I mean...
Yeah. There was an amount of that because it is, you know, it just thumps you. So there were certainly times when I would just go to bed and sleep for 3 days.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I'm in the countryside. The thing about the thyroid thing is that I had a hyperactive thyroid. So for 3-4 days, eventually in the far end of it, I just would not be able to sleep at all.
Gosh.
So I would go out for dawn walks. Which here means you meet deer, you meet, you know, the marsh harriers.
Brilliant.
You see the kestrels hunting. You're walking through the cobwebs across every path because nobody else has walked there. You're seeing a generation of birds grow up. It was absolutely stunning wildflowers, if you remember 2020. Couldn't smell anything, but they were very beautiful.
Well, the weather was great, wasn't it? The weather was great.
Weather was terrific. Nightingales.
Gosh.
In my little town, across the river is the Fingerin Ho Nature Reserve where they have nightingales. But, of course, it was so quiet. There was a nightingale at the back of my house, you know, singing to the other nightingale that was 20 yards away.
Of course there was.
So when I was feeling well, I was either kayaking out at dawn and the seals... very relaxed and there's nobody else about, so the seals would come and look at you.
Brilliant.
Marsh harriers would come across. So being with nature, which I always find very restorative, but it was particularly precious and restorative. And I also was doing, which I've done for a very long time, my Tai Chi.
Ah.
Which I like.
Is Tai Chi something you have to do, I mean, I'm not being silly, is it something you have to do outside?
It's interesting. There are sort of rules about it, yeah. Doing it outside. It's very lovely to do outside. It's lovely to do on a flat beach, for example, but
right.
Hard sand beach. And animals find it fascinating.
Oh, really?
Dogs, cats, they will just sit and watch you. They won't run up to you. You know, and I'm a person, everybody's dog runs up to me. Dogs love me. But if I'm doing Tai Chi, they won't. They'll just sit and they'll watch. And when I finish, they'll run up. There's something that they find sort of fascinating.
They pick up the vibe.
Yeah, sort of fascinating and calming. But they do say if you're doing Tai Chi, you shouldn't do it if there's wind, because the wind will kind of do something to your chi. I mean, it may well be they're just saying don't get too cold.
So that was a really good thing, sort of, you know, it replenished. Did you find, strange question, did you find people got back in touch with you who you hadn't spoken to for a long, long time?
A little bit at the beginning. there are people in my life that I email back and forth that I've never met, and they've emailed me about a book.
Right.
And for some reason, we have continued to email. And those correspondences became much firmer and more consistent, partly because I could be more consistent because I wasn't endlessly traveling. And once a week, I write to somebody who's in an old folks' home who I still haven't seen because she's, you know, very frail. And she's forgotten how to work a phone. So I was sending her things. A friend of mine's got pre-senile dementia. So quite early on in lockdown, her husband was sort of saying, do you want to write to her? So there's this sort of series of correspondences with people.
Yes. And what about, you know, do you regret not becoming a major shareholder in Zoom?
Well, I mean, I suppose that would have been a good thing to do, but no, I mean, it was wonderful to, I mean, I always hated Hangout. I always hated Skype. I, you know, all of the video conferencing seemed terrible,
yeah,
and clunky and dreadful. And I would always be in some inconvenient place trying to do it on a, you know, half a megabit per hour Wi-Fi, and then suddenly there was this very good smooth one. And yeah, suddenly I remember having a Christmas sort of get together on Zoom with people, and it just being terribly moving, and the intimacy of looking in people's eyes and saying things that you definitely normally say, but you look away. And I know people find it exhausting and all kinds of other things, yeah, but I want to continue to remember the first 2 months of just thinking, the people who are up for this and the intimacy of this, I am suddenly having conversations that are infinitely deeper. I mean, yeah, we're not here and we can't share a cup of tea and we can't have a hug, but also I don't care. We're communicating in a way that's very new and is very eye to eye and is quite, you know, it's like the late night when most of the people have left the party communication, but you don't have to wait 5 hours to just be eye to eye with somebody.
No, I think there was masses of really great things about it that saved a lot of people's bacon. You know, particularly people who are very isolated, didn't have folks around them or anything. It's huge.
And with my mum, you know, it's relatively simple to do that stuff, and yeah, I could say, I know it's a bit of a pain, but I can show you my garden and you can show me your garden,
yeah,
and we're not visiting each other, because I was sort of, I mean, I, you know, I relearned to drive, I bought a car, I haven't had a car for 10 years, but you know, I was on and off way too ill to be driving.
Yeah,
it's kind of 200 miles to drive to my mother.
So, you know, I mean, it's not to drone on about the lockdown. I just think it was a very interesting thing in the sense that it challenged quite a lot of people. And I think it probably challenged you in certain ways. And also, as a writer, you know, I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine, you know, writing is pretty important to you for various reasons. But, you know, one is to feel good about Alison. So if you're not writing, the, you know, the self-esteem department could take a dent.
I don't know if it makes me feel good about me, but it's basically a meditation. It's like a long-form meditation, because I cannot have the interior monologue of whatever the hell, largely negative bullshit, or,
yeah,
you know, there is no interior monologue. Because what I'm doing is thinking a different monologue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this meditation. So I spend hours a day not being where I am, not being who I am. And it's huge relief.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a glorious thing. The rest of it, the career, I mean, obviously it's also how I earn my living. And I have not noticeably been good at earning my living any other way, so it's worrying if I cannot do it.
Yes.
What I did do in 2020 was write lots of short things. I wrote a libretto for an opera. I wrote a couple of long poems. You know, I could do short stuff. I just couldn't do what I was trying to do, which is this novel.
And that was the one you were going to go to the cabin in the States.
Yeah, well, I kicked it off in the cabin, but
oh, right, okay.
It ended up being set in 2020, and it is most appropriate that it should be set in 2020, so I actually couldn't really write it properly without being in at least 2021. So it all turned out all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I did love, there was that very, very brief time, the maybe only 2-3 weeks, when the entire world was washing its hands and the entire world was looking at medical professionals and thinking, damn, you're amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the van drivers were as important as the van drivers always are. And we noticed.
Yes.
And all of the people who do the awful jobs without which society won't function were essential workers, and we understood it. And everybody was saying thank you.
Well, yes, the gratitude-o-meter was functioning.
Yeah, you were, you know, tears in your eyes if something arrived in a box, and we were all wearing masks because we cared about each other, and we were all giving each other thumbs up and finding different ways to be friendly, and the windows yeah. were full of teddy bears and full of rainbows, and obviously then that offended a variety of powers that be, and suddenly there's this huge online psyops efforts to make sure that everybody gets divided along every possible line, and we fight constantly, and suddenly everything is very controversial. But there, you know, there was a beautiful 2-3 weeks of right now pretty much everybody on earth is doing much the same things that I'm doing and feeling much the same things that I'm feeling, and we're one species, and that's the truth.
Yes. Well, I think that's a very lovely way of looking at that, and I'm sure that did all happen. I sort of seem to remember people either being very aware of other people and actually doing something about it, and sort of going, look, I'm going to put the apple pie over the fence. Here you are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I think
yeah.
that was great. But I also think it accentuated quite a lot of bad things. Bad in the sense of, you know, woe is me, it's all going to be dreadful, I hate everybody, and, you know, I'm angry about this. And blah, blah, blah. I think that, you know, just the fact that people were sort of locked up for so long did have a neg effect. And
oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm saying, you know, first 2-3 weeks.
Yeah, oh, right, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yes,
first
yeah.
2-3 weeks. Beyond that, politicians don't like it. Beyond that, Facebook becomes a nest of ridiculous conspiracies.
Oh, yes.
Beyond that, a variety of murder-suicide cults develop and decide to scream. You know, lots of people don't like unity. Lots of people don't like concerted action and peace and stability because it's not as profitable as chaos. So then you had the chaos engineers come in. But it was a very special time, that first 2-3 weeks.
Yes, I see what you mean. Okay, yeah.
And then there was a monster pushback. So now everything is controversial. I mean, probably, yeah, I haven't checked the papers, but it's probably controversial to wear socks by now. And
yes.
27% of the population think if you wear socks, then you like sawing live rabbits in half.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually.
And tomorrow they'll be more convinced of it than ever, and it'll be part of their personality, and you can't dissuade them. You know, it's all of those games, and people are playing very cruel games, literally, with other people's lives.
But I think, you know, I'm very aware of stuff like anger being an issue for a lot of people that, you know, that they had very little way of expressing it. Well, of course, some people did express it. But, you know, if it's not a leading question, does that happen to you where you think, excuse me, my rageometer is really going, you know, up? I mean, how do you deal with anger yourself? Do you write about it? Do you take a cricket bat and bash up the nearest pillow or what?
Anger's interesting. Anger's certainly, you know, with the Twitter stuff, with the Facebook stuff, with the online stuff, it's all designed to make you angry. And the interesting thing
and react
and the thing about anger is it's never the first thing that you feel. Anger is always, and I remember a very nice lady called Anne, she's dead now. I remember a lady giving me a lift home, and she said, you do realise that anger's the second thing you feel. And I immediately became furious. because she was quite right. Generally, what you feel is afraid, and of course, we were all afraid, and makes you feel naked and not who you thought, not as powerful as you want to be. I mean, you can't be powerful in the face of a tsunami or a pandemic or death. You know, we are not powerful. We are deluded if we think that we are. You know, you either feel afraid or you feel threatened or injured. It's a cover-up. And the minute you actually realise, ah, I'm furious, then, you know, what I try and do is just, well, what is it then? Because, you know, anger's irrelevant. Anger's a distraction from whatever I should be dealing with. It's generally fear, hurt, pride. I get absolutely incandescently, instantaneously furious if you threaten people I love.
Right.
You know, if you harm or threaten to harm my mother, you know.
That's 0 to 60 straight away.
Oh, 60?
No.
Come on.
Okay.
you know.
But what do you do about it, Alison? That's the thing. I mean, because it is quite healthy to express it appropriately.
Well, I don't know, because it's not a real thing.
No.
It's fakery. That's the thing about all of the, you know, the online stuff. It's all based on lies, which are producing in me, or trying to, a different lie, which is, I'm angry. It's like, yeah, but what are you really? And then can you do something about it? And that sort of stops it. You know, I mean, just go for a walk, take a breath. If you want to roll a newspaper up and hit a couch or something, you know, fine. But a lot of the time, I think it's one of these things, once you've rumbled it, it affects you differently because, you know, it's like, yeah, I could sit here and be furious that my entire life has been derailed since early 2020. I could be outraged by the fact that my health has been lousy for 2 years. I could be outraged that there's a pandemic. I could be outraged, but it's not going to change any of that. It's just going to make me more ill and more stressed.
Surely then that comes down to the, you know, what can you do about it? Can you do anything about it to change it, or can you just accept it?
Well, I mean, you know, I can do certain things. I've got a certain responsibility to do the best to keep the people around me safe. And to keep me safe and to do positive and creative things in the world. And if I'm on Twitter, I mean, yeah, I will get into barnies with people on Twitter. But, I mean, if somebody puts up a photograph of their kid who's done something good or their daughter dressed for a wedding or blah, blah, you know, I try and make a point of, if I'm on Twitter on any given day, saying that's great or thank you or that's beautiful or I hope you had a good day. And then I don't feel shitty.
Right.
Because all of that stuff is contagious, and I'd rather be doing the stuff that's contagiously positive. Because the other stuff is just, it's impractical and it's a mug's game. That's the thing. It feels viscerally correct and justified and righteous, but it's not. It's somebody taking me, you know, my grandfather was a card sharp. My grandfather was a middleweight boxer who did a lot of his boxing bare knuckle.
Really?
And and even down in London, he was from Staffordshire, but he was an apprentice in London. And even in the ring, you know, he was the guy, he would punch you and he'd try and rake the metal ends of the laces of his gloves over your eyes to make your eyes bleed. He'd stand on your feet if the ref wasn't looking, he'd punch you. You know, he was looking to beat you.
Right.
And if you were on a train with him, going on holiday, you know, Blackpool or whatever, he was the guy who would say, "It's a bit dull, isn't it? I'm tired of looking out the window. Have you ever played this thing called poker? Because I've always wanted to try.
Right.
And I've got cards. Will we have a go?" And he'd take your holiday money, which then became his holiday money.
Okay.
And when he got off the train, he had a much nicer time than you did. And he taught me there are people, you know, not in a paranoid way. He just said there are people out there and it's their business to be good at that. And it's your business to be aware that they're out there and not be a mug.
So what, that was he saying hit first?
No, he was just saying, you know, not everybody is your friend.
Yeah.
And he taught me a version of Find the Lady, you know, where you have like two kings and a queen and you've put the three cards down and the mug punter has to guess where the queen is, find the lady. And he taught me a version where you throw them down. It's not a version I've seen anywhere, actually. You throw them down, but you release them in an order. They land in exactly the same place every time. It looks as if you've done exactly the same thing every time, but you move the queen wherever you want. And he taught me how to do this, and I only saw him for 2 weeks a year at Easter at that point. And I practiced for a year so that I could throw them down so that they landed in exactly the right place and I could put the queen anywhere you like. I practiced and practiced and practiced, so I got it right. And then I showed him, and every single time, and this, you know, the cards are face down, every single time, because it was a thing that he couldn't be kind about, because being kind was not useful in this context, he would say, queen's there, and he'd be right. And he'd
really?
Say, queen's there, and he'd be right. And what he was doing was teaching me that if you're with somebody like him, the backs of the cards, unless it's brand... Well, no, just unless it's a brand new pack of cards, the backs of the cards are all very slightly different. And he's somebody who knows, you know, he's Cambridge Analytica. He knows.
How did that come in?
Because those are the guys who are treating us as mug punters. You know, they know about human nature. People who want you to be a mug know about human nature. Like, wearing a mask is uncomfortable and a bit of a pain in the neck. Okay, so how do we turn the heat up on that so that it becomes something that makes people screamingly crazy? It's already quite unpleasant. So let's turn the heat up. All they do is engineer the way you feel and make minor inconveniences into things that become outrageous. So, you know, it's interesting. But, I think primary school children should at least be taught about basic tricksterism.
That's very interesting. I had no idea about that. Well, I give talks to a lot of schools, and I do actually advocate a slightly different policy. What I do say is, if you are the type of person who feels it's uncool or you're afraid to express anything anger-wise, and you just stuff it down, which a certain amount of people do, this is not a good thing. You know, when you're a certain age, you don't know all that.
Yeah, it's a process. No, when you're five and somebody's torn your teddy bear in half, you're upset. Because it's not fair. A lot of things when you're tiny, it's not fair. And you have huge feelings because you're tiny.
Well, that's right. And you're all pretty sensitive. Okay. Well, look, let's just go back. So with the lockdown and with you as a writer, so the human being and the writer, the same thing probably, what have you sort of learnt from this? You know, practically speaking, you know, what have you learnt? If there's someone who's 19 years old who wants to be a writer, is a writer, and they're going, oh, my God, it's A.L. Kennedy. Mm. What's she telling me? What are you? I mean, were there things that you've learnt from this or still learning from it?
I've been running for more than 30 years. I'm more than 50 years old. There isn't a lot that's new.
Right.
By this point, the thing that gets new is the way you look at things you thought you knew. And the depth that I'm willing to allow things to penetrate. I mean, quite a long time ago, I did a book about deception and about fake mediums and about magic and about tricksters and trickery.
Yeah.
Because that was clearly on the way. And I was talking to lots of people who were, in some cases, actual stage magicians, who are interesting because they're liars, but they show up and they say, I'm a liar, but it's fun. The agreement is that I'm a liar. The agreement is that I will steal your watch, but you'll get it back. It's entertainment. They call themselves sometimes, between themselves, thaumaturges, or magic becomes thaumaturgy, which is, you know, it's just the working of wonders. It's an interesting word because that used to be a word for saints. It used to be, you know, capital W, wonders. But because magicians will nick anything, they nicked thaumaturgy. So it's become the posh word for doing pick a card, any card, is it the three clubs? Which is a little bit small as far as wonders go. But there's this one magician who was sort of saying, you know, he'd done this trick with a ring. For I remember the woman had taken it off and just forgotten that she'd taken it off. And he sleight of handed it and then made it appear for her. But he didn't know that it was very connected with a family member who'd passed on, and it was deeply emotional, and she could only remember having left it upstairs in her hotel room, and suddenly it's in her hand. And for her, it was this, it was wonderful. It was this thing that wasn't just, ta-da, three of clubs. It was, here's a little bit of the love of your mother, and oh, just a shifting of the world. He is something that's genuinely wonderful. And he was sort of saying, I think magic should do that. And I was sitting there thinking, shit, art should do that. I should be writing to do that.
Mm.
But that's the work of a lifetime, because you'll never get that right.
That's a huge thing.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're not going to try and do a huge thing, why the fuck are you bothering, really? So it was, you know, how do I try and give people a thing that's wonderful? And again, I love Stephen Colbert, you know, the American comedian.
Yeah.
Very interesting guy. And looking at interviews with him, I mean, and he's quite spiritual and he's quite profoundly Catholic.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he has a sort of a way of approaching that. And he's a very thoughtful, bright guy. But there's a thread running through his stuff, which is, I will be a thing that will help you get through. And as it turned out, it was, I will be a thing that will help you get through 45th president. And then, and then of course, during lockdown, he's broadcasting from home and you suddenly have this completely different relationship. It was as if the time, you know, he was ready, pre-ready for the time.
Yeah.
Because then he's in his home improvising initially how you do a TV show from home, but we've baked in the idea of, I am here to get you through it.
Great.
He's got this extraordinary relationship now with his audience. And I mean, watching him, particularly in the early days of lockdown, it's like, oh, thank God, here we are. Here's a man in a suit sitting in his own bath in a suit covered in bubbles. And it's like, yeah, that's what I need today, is a man in a suit covered in bubbles. Just we're gonna get through this. And again, you know, you're trying to think, how do I write a thing because people will come up occasionally and say they liked a book, or they'll say your book got me through a divorce. Now, I mean, a book does that anyway because it's a distraction. And it doesn't really matter what the book is. It's that they happen to have your book and it was distracting enough that they got through the divorce.
Liked it.
But it's like, what if I aimed for that? What if I aimed for something that is in some way wonderful and something that is in part designed to get you through? And if I go for those two things. I mean, I remember Alistair MacLeod, wonderful short story writer, Canadian guy.
Okay.
And I remember doing an on-stage thing, sort of emceeing him and asking him questions, which was a little bit terrifying.
Right.
And there's a point where he was, you know, what do you aim for in a short story? And he just leaned forward with his hands on his knees, looking at the audience. And he said, what he was aiming for was, you've got to read this story. It's going to change your life. And again, it's like, yeah, why not? You know, why else are you bothering if you're not aiming that high? You'll fail, but you'll get higher than you thought you could.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, once I felt a little bit better and I was very relieved that I was on medication for the thyroid, you think, all right, I will now do a novel about getting through 2020 and I will try to aim for, this will change your life, this will get you through, this will be wonderful. Failing on all three points, but if you muck about and you're half-hearted with art, you don't get art. It is about jumping off a cliff and just assuming that eventually you'll grow wings. But, you know, before you hit the ground, you'll have grown wings.
Yeah, keep that thought for a second and let's move, because when we do the shed talks, we always have this thing of life jackets of, you know, what's going to see people through and everything. And, you know, you've chosen two books, Lord of the Rings and Moby Dick. And I wonder, you know, I look at what you just said. You know, those did make quite a difference, those books. You know, they were big in their own way. And some people might think Moby Dick isn't, but I don't think that's true. What do you say about that?
The Lord of the Rings is quite obvious. I started reading it in 2020, cause apart from anything else, because I just thought it's long. It'll be a place I can go to.
Yes.
That's long. And yeah. I read it first when I was very, very young, and I hadn't read it for a while. And it's like, it's somebody who'd been through World War One, who understood trauma, who understood what a fellowship is, what bonds forged in stress are. And he writes here and there very beautifully about the hope in dark places.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sam has a very beautiful speech about the starlight still above the cloud. And I found myself weeping at it in a way that I never had, which was great. And it's, you know, it's a rattling good story. And again, it's somebody who had a definite aim. I want to make a myth, a new myth, something that is so strong and detailed and alive that it will change people, which is grand. And it's very good-hearted, and it understands small people swept up in terrible events, which is the story of most people. Yes, it's about heroes, but it's largely about people who aren't heroes. They're people who have to become heroes because they're terribly challenged, which is a very true story.
Yeah.
You know, we forget how extraordinary people can be. Moby Dick, it's sort of about the reverse, how that goes wrong. I mean, it's beautiful to be with. It's beautifully written. It's very funny and crazed. And it's the flip side of human nature. It's like, I have decided, you know, Ahab is obsessed with the thing that he wants. He's just all twisted willpower. And he sort of kidnaps a crew when they're already at sea, but he just does what somebody does when they're trying to hypnotize you to bring you along on a murder-suicide pact. I will make you wealthy. But ultimately, it's not even about money, because they're giving up other whales to pursue the great white whale.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. And the last time I read it, I was on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic, and it was just peak Moby Dick, because I love the sea. I just can't get enough of this. Oh, Lord, yeah. My mother was expecting me when she came back on a boat, the Himalaya.
From Australia.
From Australia. So my earliest experiences of being alive, really, are of bobbing about.
You've got the rhythm of the sea.
I love it. And when I was teeny tiny, I was sick on aeroplanes. If I went near a car, I was sick. And then we did a little boat trip, I think, out to the Isle of May or something. And both my parents were quite queasy. And I wasn't sick. It was like I had a superpower. It's like, oh, I love this.
Right, well, we could be getting you an ocean liner then immediately. I'll get that arranged. Now, you chose a movie, which I have to confess I have not seen, which is called Funny Bones. Oliver Platt, Jerry Lee Lewis. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lee Evans, I think.
Lee Evans probably being peak glorious Lee Evans. It's got Freddie Parrotface Davis.
And it's all set in Blackpool.
All set in Blackpool. It's about comedy. It's about whether you've got funny bones or not. It's about funny. It's about being funny. And Oliver Platt is ostensibly Jerry Lee Lewis's son.
Right.
But Jerry Lee Lewis is funny, but he very beautifully sort of satirizes himself, and he's a slightly heartless, slightly too glossy, but very effective kind of suit-wearing comedian.
Right.
And Oliver Platt is one of those guys who's just an eighth of the beat wrong, and he'll say the right lines, but they're not right. And he's got an anger in him. You know, he hates the audience. You can't hate the audience.
Oh, okay.
There's sort of a way to do it, but he's not doing it the only way you could do it. So, and he flees to Blackpool to look at other people's material. And actually what he wants to do is to steal other people's material. But he ends up going on this voyage of discovering who he is. And when he knows who he is, he becomes funny.
I shall definitely watch that. I loved your choice of music. Jimmy Durante and Make Somebody Happy. I thought that was brilliant. We're going to play that. I mean, it's great. I thought that sort of summed you up in a way, because I think certain people think that you're quite dour, and there's definitely not that side of you. And I thought that was really a great, fantastic choice.
It's sort of quite profound lyrics. There's also a Bill Nye version. And I work with it a lot, and it would, you know, I'm trying to get compact things that would remind me a lot of a lot of different things. But no, yeah. it's quite a nice, it's a sort of profound lyric, and you'll need a laugh when you're there.
Well, that's very true. That's very true. And the kayaking you've told us about, which is really excellent, FAB. You have avoided, however, not mentioning anything to do with gardening, Alison. How do you plead?
No, I love gardens, but I don't really mind, as long as they're correct for the place or the house or the environment or whatever, I don't mind. So, I mean, you can have a Jacobean not garden if you want. I mean, I don't like them super tight like that myself. But what I love is... In a way, it's an unhealthy lawn, but I love a lawn, you know, a Georgian lawn or a Victorian lawn that's very deep and cushiony, and that's technically because it's quite moss-infested, but not so moss-infested that it's dying. You know, like a really long-established, long-loved lawn.
That's great. But do you have... any sort of garden? I mean, do you plant things? Do you grow anything, even if it's a gardenia?
I mean, as I say, here we went from nothing to beds. I love things that smell, so it's a very small garden here. But
right.
I have night-scented jasmine. I have the normal Lonicera. I have a Lonicera japonica, so that, you know, will flower 2-3 times in the year. Passion vines sort of self-seed here. So I've got, you know, passion vine, gooseberries, tayberries, black currants. Happy about that. It's a very dark garden that I've got. So
okay.
There's a lot of experiments with hellebore, but you get really attractive hellebore. And I have a hyssop. A purple hyssop.
A hyssop? I have heard of it, but there you got me on that.
I went to Sachsenhausen concentration camp, and it was a very, as you can imagine, strange day. Because you're effectively going by train from Berlin.
Oh, blimey.
To, you know, the railway station that you would have been delivered to, and then marching in the way that you would have marched to Sachsenhausen. And as I was coming back... to Oranienburg railway station, and you know, they ran that whole awful system of thousands of camps out of Oranienburg, out of one building with very few people, because it was a sort of franchising,
right?
Awful
God.
Structure. But there was a beautiful hyssop plant, so I thought, I will rescue you, hyssop, from Oranienburg.
And you did.
Yeah, and I you know, I brought it back to where I was staying in Berlin. Brought it home, planted it. Doesn't really like very cold temperatures, and there have been two beasts from the east, and it went back to a stump, but it came back again, and it's doing very well. So yeah, I'm very fond of my Oranienburg rescued hyssop.
Oh well, that's a really good story. I like that.
Yeah, as I say, it's a dark garden, so it's lots of. You know, it's ferns and hellebore, basically. And there's a thing called, I don't know what the posh name for it is, but a thing called Spotty Dotty, which is magnificent, sort of umbrelliferous spotted mad thing.
Well,
so it's mainly, you know, you're playing with leaf shape and shades of green, because actually getting a flower to, like, there's only really a couple of places that get enough sun for there to be flowers, particularly.
That is brilliant. Well, we sort of really come to the end of our time. Thank you so much, Alison, for coming to do this. And the stacks of stuff that's been discussed, which is really, really great. One day we'll have to do it again, because there's so much in your life that's interesting, to me anyway. I really wanted to talk about your, I was going to be rude and say obsession. I think I'll say great interest in Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah. Well, another force for good in the universe. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I read about what you said about it, and I just loved that way. I think you just liked it because it was pure storytelling, and you know, it was pure, and something you really enjoyed doing and enjoyed watching.
And nice people. I mean, I don't generally enjoy literary parties particularly, and I got invited to, I think it must have been the 50th anniversary of the show.
Yeah.
It's a party, and it's at the Groucho Club, and it's that, oh, man, I'm not even going to have my coat in at the door, because I'm not going to be there for very long.
Yeah.
And I had a blast. There was nobody you couldn't talk to. Best snacks. And we had an absolutely delightful time, and there was not a bit of the sort of poisonousness of showbiz or,
yeah,
you know, argumentativeness or anything. It was just such a lovely, friendly, unified, nice time.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And you left at 1:30 in the morning.
Well, we don't stay up that late, because we're into, but no, it was very lovely.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, Alison, what can I say? My groovometer has shot up to 8.9.
Well, there you go.
I think everyone else's, when they hear this, will be recording a similar reading.
Okay, take care.
Speak very soon.
Yeah, all
okay.
Right.
Bye. Thanks, take care.
It's so important to make someone happy. Make just one someone happy. Make just one heart-to-heart you. You sing to one smile that cheers you. One face that lights when it nears you. One girl, you're everything to fame. If you win it, comes and goes in a minute. Where's the real stuff in life to cling to? Love is the answer. Someone to love is the answer. Once you've found her, build your world around. Just one someone happy, and you will be happy too.